This is episode 381 of Jumble Think.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Jumble Think, where we interview dreamers, makers, innovators, and influencers all about their journey of turning dreams and ideas into reality. Along the way, we're going to share some tips on how you can turn your own dreams and ideas into reality too. On the show today, our guest is Jeff DeGraff. More about Jeff in a moment. Whether you're a new listener or a longtime fan, if you've never subscribed to Jumble Think, now's the time to do it. Head on over to wherever you listen to podcasts, search for Jumble Think, and subscribe. To make it even easier, if you head on over to jumblethink.com, you'll find links to Apple Podcasts, Pandora, Spotify, and more. So go subscribe to the show now and never miss another great conversation. Now let's join today's conversation. Hey there, friends. Welcome to Jumble Think. My name is Michael Woodward. I am your host. Wow, what a journey this has been. The Jumble Think podcast. What a crazy ride. The amazing conversations, the people we've met, the fun we've had. We started the show back in January of 2017, and now we're getting ready for episode 400, only a couple weeks away. And it's amazing. It's amazing to think the people we've talked to, the conversations we've had, the topics we've covered, the things I've been able to share with you. When I started the show, it was with a simple challenge, to challenge you to think differently, to examine your dreams, your ideas, your concepts, and hopefully to challenge you to create, to innovate, to chase those dreams, to create those ideas. And for many of our listeners, you've done that. You've taken steps into the unknown. Well, today we're doing something a little bit different with the show. We are bringing back one of the first guests to the show, an episode that I was super excited about back then, a guest that I was just fascinated with what he does. Today we're bringing him back, and I'm just as fascinated with what he does, just excited, as excited to have him back on the show. His name is Jeff DeGraff. His original episode was episode 12. It aired on March 2nd of 2017. It seems like a lifetime ago. He has a new book out. It was released September 29th of 2020 called The Creative Mindset, Mastering the Six Skills That Empower Innovation. He is a professor of management and organization at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. He's written several books. He has coined terms that we use on this show, like innovation happens at the edges. I was beyond excited to have Jeff on the show back in 2017. I'm even more excited to continue the conversation, to go deeper into this concept of creativity. And I hope it really does challenge you. Today's conversation challenges you to go deeper into the ideas and dreams inside of you. So let's go ahead and join the conversation with today's guest, Jeff DeGraff. Thank you so much for coming back on.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
You know, I remember early on in the podcast journey and radio and the other outlets that we're on, thinking about the kind of guests that I wanted on the show, and you are the ideal guest. We love dreams, we love ideas, we love people turning those dreams and ideas into reality, and it takes creativity and innovation to do that. You're the guy that teaches that, that helps people to do it, so I'm glad to have you back on.
Thanks for having me on.
You have a book that came out last September 2020, in the dark ages of COVID. It is called The Creative Mindset, Mastering the Six Skills That Empower Innovation. It's a really cool book. I'm halfway through, and there it is. I recommend it highly for anyone that wants to think creativity creatively. You actually create a word, create advisors, in that book. And beyond that, one of the other things that's fascinating about the book is that you wrote it not only with a colleague, but your spouse, which is like pretty cool.
Yeah, she runs all the, you know, I have these innovation centers around the country, Innovatriums. And, you know, we were pioneers in that. I mean, going back 20, 30 years, and she runs them. Yeah. So I'm not actually the CEO. She is.
You know, I found in my life, in our life as a family, it's best to keep my wife the boss. She does a better job of it.
No comment on that, but certainly in my family, we know who the more prepared and qualified person is. And you're right about that.
Now, beyond having these innovation centers, you're also a professor at the University of Michigan at the, I want to make sure I'm getting, Ross School of Business.
And yeah, 30 years.
Wow, that's incredible. For those who missed the first episode, now, you'll have to forgive me if you listen to it. I was early in my journey. I'm a much better interviewer now, but go back and definitely check it out because we get into Jeff's story a little bit deeper. But can you give us a little sparkline of how you got interested in this concept of creativity and innovation?
Yeah, I did my PhD in an area that would now be typically referred to as artificial intelligence. I was the last graduate student of the man who really founded this whole field of design thinking, Rudolf Arnheim. In fact, when he had a stroke, I came back to Ann Arbor, bought his house.
Wow.
I went to and did something crazy. I came to Ann Arbor to work in the medical school to develop a technology to help M1s, first year medical students, diagnose diseases, early artificial intelligence stuff. I hated it. Met a guy in a hippie bar who worked for a guy with a $20 million pizza company. And 5 years and several $1 billion later, I sold it to Mitt Romney and Bain Capital. It was Domino's Pizza. And I was going to retire at 29.
Wow.
And I met Bob Quinn, who had a huge influence on my life. Robert Quinn, the famous professor, and he brought me to Michigan and I've been here ever since.
You know, one of the things that fascinates me about you, and there are a pocket of business professors who do this, that they go beyond the confines of the theory and they're out in the world doing this. You consult a lot, you speak on this. You're yeah. really engaged in the world of business. And we've been fortunate to have several professors from business schools, innovation experts come on the show. And all of them are truly engaged with the world around them. I think that there's this shift on how we approach education and how we engage it. And COVID's, I think, rapidly changed that. So for you, having your foot both in the world of consulting, having these innovation centers and teaching it, that seems like a super power almost because you have an insight.
It would seem like that. It's becoming actually quite, I think, less popular. You know, I came up in an era where being a business school professor meant that you were sitting on board, you were advising senior leaders, you were in the mix. I don't think that's true anymore.
Wow.
I think much more it's focused on peer research and you know, writing more academic pieces, which early in my career I did.
Yeah.
But I think that moment of realizing that all the professional schools are basically sort of advanced vocational education. Think about medicine and you're a surgeon, you're a law school professor, you know, you should be trying cases. Mm-hmm. I'm just an old guy who believes that if you're a business school professor, you should be in businesses. And I woke up one day about 5 or 6 years ago and realized I'd been in half of the Fortune 500, a little over half of it.
Wow.
And, well, you learn a few things out in the world, and there's a very distinct kind of challenge in the academy. In the academy, there's a real strong belief that the theory translates into practice, and in the real world, we believe practice translates into theory.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just an old John Dewey kind of, you know, see one, do one, teach one kind of guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's great that that there still are some of us around. I'm not sure that that's really the model anymore.
Which is really sad to me because I think that it is so important to be engaged in the world that you teach. And
I don't know how you would teach. What strikes me as odd is I don't know how you do how you'd be a professor of surgery if you didn't do surgeries, how you'd be a law professor. I don't get why that's not more the standard.
Yeah,
but it's
yeah.
not. I mean, really, we're very clearly moving to an era of, you know, sort of back to where we used to be in the maybe 50, 60 years ago, where it's sort of pure research.
Yeah.
Which just I'm what they used to call a pracademic, you know, a practicing academic.
Which I think is the way that it should be. And I love that about you. I want to pivot into the book a little bit. There are six skills. You created an acronym of CREATE to define those. Can you walk us through those six skills quickly?
Yeah, I tried to do something clever. The original draft of the book, Michael, was to show a hierarchy of creative skills. And remember, I started teaching creativity to business school students 30 some years ago. I think Michael Ray at Stanford was the only other person who was doing it.
Yeah.
I wanted to create a mnemonic device that sort of represented this. So it doesn't necessarily go in the order I had originally researched it. So the C in CREATE stands for clarify, which I wanted it to be more in line with the rest of the terms here, but my publisher wanted it to be clearer. So the C is clarify, which simply means the biggest problem I think young people have is they get the problem wrong.
Yeah.
They solve the wrong problem.
Yeah.
And I think I see a lot of people do that. We've all been on the project that was a dead end because it was the wrong thing. The R stands for replicate, which comes to us from our friend Aristotle, who calls this mimesis or mimetic, which is where we get the word mime from, right? Yeah. To mime,
yeah.
Which just means you search and reapply solutions from other places. You're copying.
Yeah.
And we know everything from orangutans to Chaldean crows do this. So it's not a unique human thing. E stands for elaborate, which is what we would typically call brainstorming.
Yeah.
The whole idea of connecting words that typically don't go together. Sometimes this is called defamiliarization. The A stands for associate, which is my favorite, which is metaphorical thinking, right? So you're using analogies and metaphors to combine things and to see new possibilities. And one of the things that I think students realize when they get to this point in the class, you know, is that their brain actually can go in reverse, which is like a startling thing to them. It's like this great revelation, like, wow, I can see where there are also holes in this thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
T stands for translate, which of course now, maybe a few years ago, we weren't so cognizant of it, but this is of course being able to tell the story, the narratology, if you will. And the E stands for evaluate, which sort of like clarify, people often leave the $1 billion idea on the wall. So these aren't necessarily steps, they're skills unto themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and what I did was I took about 30 years of experience and probably 70 years of research, and I boiled it down into something simple that, you know, you could do if you were striking out on your own and creating a restaurant, or you were an executive in a big company, or you were starting something and you were kind of stuck. So I tried to make it as user-friendly as possible.
Now, you use the word mastery in the title of the book. To me, it seems like this is a journey of growth, that these skills have to be practiced, that they have to be applied, that the only way that you sharpen this is by doing it. You know, I the world I swim in is a lot of entrepreneurs. I own a web agency, so we talk to a lot of high tech. We're working with clients that are large Fortune 100 companies down to mom and pop. And those people think differently than the average employee, the average person. And I know so many people I talk to who will say, you know, I have an idea, I have a dream, I have something I want to do, but I don't want to leave the safety of my job. I don't want to leave the safety of comfortable. This is known, that's unknown. And they feel like there's something special about those people who we look at as superhuman in a way, but also skilled at what they do. Like, they're the pinnacle of reaching this. And you even addressed that at the beginning of the book about how a lot of these creative people are not all that special. They just have something unique about them, and the fact that, and I want to get this right here, that the motivation trumps talent and intellect, I think is the way you put it.
I think that's true. I would say this, there's a lot of studies on creativity and creative thinking, and that they've really gotten much better in the last decade. One of the things we're beginning to figure out is there's no correlation between IQ and your ability to make things better and new, which is what creativity is. There is a great concern in the educational community about something called cognitive mobility in young people, particularly in young people. And whether it's, helicopter parents, or whether it's there's an app for that, or whether it's the anxiety of achievement that we've all sort of pushed on our children. One of the things that I feel very strongly about is that all these creative skills are developed, mm-hmm. and they're developed in a see one, do one, teach one way. So that's why I originally built the Innovatrims, right? So that people could be apprenticed and they could learn the skill. There's a real misnomer, I think, and it's, and again, it comes back to something I think we've done, we haven't done a very good job with our young people. We, you know, we cut their arts programs and their English programs, and, you know, and then we wonder why we're here with this challenge of cognitive mobility. And you can imagine that if you're going to be the, you know, the top dog, if you will, which the United States has been for a long time, you really need people who can think very differently than other people. And so what you're beginning to see is something that we haven't seen to this extreme before in this country, which is you're beginning to see a creative class, as Richard Florida calls it, right? And I think he's right on, where these people are making a lot of money. They're making things better and new. They're sort of pulling away, and then, and maybe even from the professional class. And then you're seeing sort of everyone else who kind of got left behind, who are sort of, you know, crossing their T's and dotting their I's. I think this whole idea of creative thinking is absolutely essential. I think I have a sense of destiny about the democratization of creativity and innovation. I think one of the things you said, I think, is not exactly right.
Okay.
I see it also in the tech economy and the biotech economy. We could talk about we just got a ringside seat to the greatest moment of creativity and innovation in the last 100 years. In the last year, we saw this. But I also see, I grew up in a working class neighborhood. I grew up in a HUD house. And I also see at the bottom of the economy some of the most creative people I've ever seen in my life. Yeah. And because they have to be, and necessity is in fact the mother of invention. But if you think about what we just saw, right? Think about the last year. By any objective standard, right? This is not a political comment. By any objective standard, our governments, our universities, our military failed completely in the management of COVID. Complete failure, abject failure.
Yeah.
Planning, processes, and penalties. It didn't work. It was an event that fell outside of that. And then I want you to think about how organically, improvisationally, 595 creativity clusters emerged. We had 116 shots on goal for phase one trials. 54 made it to phase two. And we got 9 in the bucket that are approved therapies, right? So from 595 to 9, and we did all this in 10 months in something that usually takes 10 years. So what I need people to get is that this isn't just a nice thing. This is an essential thing.
Yeah.
This is why we're moving forward. We're getting out of this. We went from being way behind, you know, 4% of the population as of the end of February was creating 28% of the deaths. I mean, that's insane. Particularly for this country, that's insane. Now we're seeing everything sort of come together. This is kind of the engine that we have. And so what I want people to get is the old model didn't work. It not only didn't work, it was a disaster.
Yeah.
The creative and innovation model works so well. Can you imagine being at the Food and Drug Administration now and trying to put the genie back in the bottle?
Yeah.
Or cancer research? So what I want your listeners to get is we have just witnessed the drop the mic moment for innovation, probably the most in 100 years.
Yeah. And I think innovation and creativity are, you know, you mentioned, is it the apps? Is it helicopter parents? What is that defining thing that's changed how we think and process? I almost feel like we've lost a sense of curiosity and wonder because so much is just available to us without having to work for it.
Yeah, I did this program. I'm on the speaking circuit a lot. I did this program with Twyla Tharp, and I love her, the great choreographer.
Yeah,
And she's a pistol, right? She's really a pistol. And you should read her book. She's really an amazing person. But what's interesting was one of the workshops we were doing, one of the young women had asked, what's going on with my, you know, what do we need to do? And Twyla in the way that she is, she had two things to say. One, she said, she said, you don't understand the level of work that has to go into this. And she talked about coming up as a female in the male-dominated choreography world of Broadway in the 1960s. But she also said, when you get information from Google, you haven't had to work for it, so it doesn't stick. You don't know what it means. And she said, so what happens is you've got a lot of kind of visceral things floating around in your head, but you don't really understand what they mean. Now, I'm not going to take it as far as she took it, but I would say this. I would say you can't make decisions until you've had sense-making, until sense-making has happened. And sense-making doesn't come from information. It comes from, you know, work and having some emotional connection to things, you know. And so that becomes, I think, one of the linchpins to cognitive range or cognitive mobility, wherever we're calling it these days. It becomes a linchpin to what sticks and what can you actually take action on.
I want to step back here. We've gone a little bit further into the pool, and you make a clear distinction between creativity and innovation, and that there's a synergy between them, but they're not the same thing.
Yeah, the line's getting blurry. I started writing about this about 92. I was asked by the federal government to help write a definition for innovation, right? For these, you know, the National Science Foundation, et cetera. used to be that innovation was just the outcome.
Okay.
Well, to make this easy for listeners, creativity is the process, the mental process, the cognitive process of thinking of something better or new and useful novelty, as we like to say. And innovation is actually the outcome of that. It's the production of useful novelty. So, you know, I'm still making the in your mind versus, you know, what goes in the world. But as you start thinking about things like design and user experience, it gets a little blurrier, right? So in my view, the bridge is just change. It's positive change. It's a form of positive change. And what I like to point out when I talk about innovation is a form of deviance. It's a form of positive deviance. And people don't get this. So anybody's ever gotten an email from me knows it's signed Vision, Courage, Freedom.
Yeah.
Vision, Courage, Freedom. There's this courage piece to it and freedom piece to it. Because the courage piece is the deviant part, because society basically, you know, pounds deviance into the ground. And, you know, I get young professors who talk to me all the time and say, well, how do I, you know, it seems to me like it's, you know, you've got all this freedom. Well, it's not true. I mean, I'm dealing with being pounded into the ground every day by everybody.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, people don't like you thinking your own thoughts, doing your own thing. So I need your listeners to get that being an innovator, it's sort of like when people say freedom isn't free. Well,
yeah.
Being an innovator isn't free. It's a lifestyle where you have to be very persistent. You have to have a lot of courage because people are going to come after you.
Yeah. I forget who said it. Maybe it was even you in our earlier interview. I just don't remember. But I remember somebody saying that innovation happens at the edges. And you mentioned that kind of deviant. That was you. Okay.
Yeah.
I remember just thinking, you know, people who think this way, people who take the risk, people who are willing to embrace this lifestyle often feel like they're outside of the norm, almost like they're looking into culture, whether they're in the business world, whether they're in education, whether they're in design or any space. They almost feel like they're on the fringe and they don't fit in, and yet they have something to offer.
Yeah, that's you've done a great job of explaining the emotional existential existence of, I think, real innovators. And I'm not sure what's the chicken and what's the egg here.
Okay.
I think a lot of innovators, when you talk to them, always feel like outsiders. I know I do.
Yeah.
And at some point people say you're the ultimate insider. And I'm like, I never feel that way. I seriously do not. And the reason is there's no amount of success you can have that will make you part of the center of this.
Yeah.
Right. So I like to think of it like a basketball team. You know, you're not big enough to drive on the lane. We're the people that sit outside the 3-point line and have developed a skill. So, you know, it's more radical, but we're making those long shots because we were just never accepted in the middle. So whenever you talk to really, I think, terrific innovators, there's always something that they've had to overcome. Now, think about Da Vinci. You know, he was a bastard, right? I mean, literally, I don't mean that in a negative way, but, you know, he was left-handed, he was gay, you know, there was a ton of stuff, but he was Da Vinci. And, you know, go look at these people historically. Tesla, it's not that you need to be that way. It's that they're trying to reconcile that they have this gift, mm-hmm. and they're trying to reconcile how that gift sort of fits into society at large. And it's a workaround.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break right here. And when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with today's guest, Jeff DeGraff. After 5 years and nearly 400 conversations, it's time for a change here at JumbleThink. Now, the show is not going to go away. You're going to still be able to listen to it wherever you're listening to it today. But we are excited to announce that we're getting back to our heartbeat, back to our original vision, back to my original dream. And that was to do the show in the video format, both with in-person and virtual interviews. And I'm excited to announce that a lot of these will be streaming live on your favorite platforms like Facebook and YouTube. Now, if you're listening, you probably have subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts, Pandora, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. But if you haven't subscribed to the show on YouTube, head on over to jumblethink.com/video. It will take you right to our YouTube channel where you can subscribe and click that notification button. By subscribing to the show, you're not going to miss any of these conversations. And as we roll out new video conversations, you're going to see a lot of really fun things. So head on over to jumblethink.com/video, subscribe to the show, turn on those notifications. And I think you're going to really enjoy the new version of JumbleThink. Now let's jump back into today's conversation with Jeff DeGraff.
The first several skills, clarity, replicate, or clarify, elaborate, and associate, seem to be about awareness of connecting unconnected things or seeing yes. things that others can't see.
Great way of putting it, Michael. That's a perfect way of putting it. I think it's what you're saying. I think it's about seeing things that have been in front of you the whole time. One of the challenges of creativity is habit-bound thinking.
Yeah.
And we all fall into it. And we all, in social media, for crying out loud, there's micro-segmenting. So all you're hearing is people pandered to you so they could sell you more soap.
Yeah.
I mean, which is ridiculous. So you have to intentionally try and free yourself, which most people won't do.
Yeah.
Most people who are listening here, you know, will decide that they're going to live within, you know, the blind spots that they've got, their dominant worldview, which I think is a shame. I think I think one of the great things about America is it's a very heterogeneous society, and diversity is key to innovation, and constructive, positive conflict is key to innovation. So I think when you surround yourself with people who just like all your stuff and believe all the same nonsense you believe, you're not growing at all. I think you have to get out of that place. So one of the things you're talking about is, you know, this whole notion of what Steve Jobs said at the Stanford in his famous last yeah. Stanford graduation address, where he said, you know, really creative people feel guilty because all they really did was see something in a different place or in a different way, and they applied it. And I think that's exactly right for the first few letters in create. I think that's true.
You know, for me, I hear what you're saying, and one of the things that pops up in my mind is the importance of seeing bias in yourself. And our world right now is cultured in such a way that we want to sit in those pockets you were talking about, whether it's the media we watch through news, whether it's social media and the buckets that we're placed in by algorithms. How do we break out of those conditioning moments and allow the freedom to really spark the connectivity that we're missing by being in these pigeoned containers, these holes that stifle our worldview?
I love what you're saying. I think the first step is to be self-aware.
Okay.
And the second step is to try and exercise people, if you will, exercise ideas out of your brain. So one of the things I do is I go on these nature walks by these parks by my house. You know, I'll drive to a park and I'll walk around for miles. And what I'm really trying to do is get people out of my head.
Yeah.
I'm trying to hear what I think about things. I'm trying to hear my rational mind. And it's hard. It's hard to shake the news. It's hard to shake the colleagues. It's hard to get to the point where you're exhibiting self-authorizing behavior, because most people don't know what they think. Yeah. And that's the first piece of getting your instrument back. And I think once you get your start to get your instrument back, you're going to realize just how you know, how much range it actually has. You're going to go, wow, I can't believe I thought that, you know, but I think the more you can't force this on people.
Right.
People aren't going to think differently if they don't want to think differently.
Yeah.
And that's part of what I don't like about a lot of the self-help movement. It's not just about you. And when we talk about mindfulness, it's not just about going inside.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, in a sense, dealing with outside and sort of pushing those things out of your mind, not just to create more. I think we've really done a poor job with a few things, like, you know, your ego is a terrible thing. Well, if you didn't have an ego, you wouldn't have any ambition.
Right.
Or, you know, it's all about, you know, balance. Well, sometimes it's about getting stuff done.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about not striving. Well, innovation requires a lot of striving. There's just a lot of stuff that I think people are, because they're traumatized by modern society. They're traumatized by what happened with COVID and they're trying to deal with it. And people deal with it in different ways. You can see this, Michael, what a lot of people did. A lot of people just went home, sat on the couch and binge watched.
Yeah.
Some people wrote a novel, mm-hmm. built a garage or painted the painting or learned a language, right? They used the time to try and move themselves to the next place. And I just think that part is the motivation part. That's not about, you know, how smart you are, what a good person you are. That's just, I want to be a different person. I want to be better or new. I'm going to do this.
Well, I was looking through my notes and I couldn't find it. So I'm going to hopefully paraphrase this correctly. And please correct me if I get it wrong. But I believe in the book you mentioned that to be creative, to be innovative, you have to believe that you have something that only you can offer.
Yeah.
That you have to think that you bring something unique and that without your voice, without your insight, the world is less off.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I learned that early in my career. I had somebody, a man I worked for, did something really quite interesting to me. I was sort of, you know, I'm that classic sort of a creative person who works all the time and doesn't know what time it is and that. So one time I went and complained to my boss and he took me through this exercise where I had to go talk to everybody about things I was incompetent at, which turned out about half of the things I was doing, which was painful. Things I was competent at, which turned out to be, you know, another quarter of the things that I was doing, which I got rid of. Things I was masterful at, which I had to train somebody else. That was like the last 20%. And then the thing was, what's the last 5%? What are you unique at? Mm-hmm. And why it was a gift. It was painful to go through this. It was a gift because three or four things came up. And for the rest of my life, that's all I did. Yeah. I did the things that I was unique at. And just like, you know, just like our friend Napoleon Hill said, think and grow rich, right?
Yeah.
He says, once you figure out what you're unique at, well, that's what you need to do. That's your specialty. And I think that's true. I think he was right.
I love the concept of micro movements. I call them micro innovation. Louis Armstrong, I think it was Louis Armstrong, who said simplicity is the most complicated form. And you look at these different things of obstacles or objections that I hear from people often. Well, it's I just don't know where to start. Oh, it's too big. Oh, I have this idea, but I don't have the revenue. You make it very clear that you have to think big by working small.
I think that's true. I call it creativizing.
Yeah.
And the reason I gave the term was taking ordinary things and adding a little creativity to them. And I think that's what real creative people do. And I think the key is you're getting momentum. That's the word. You want to get positive momentum. Somebody asked me recently about what would something they should read about creativity or something that would really get them to understand this. I said, it's not something to read. I said, go rent the movie Moneyball.
Okay.
And I said, even if you don't like baseball, just rent the movie Moneyball. And you're going to see a guy who can't quite make it all work, a guy who's had a lot of failure in his life, and he's trying a bunch of micro moves. And what eventually happens is he figures something out, right? And this is literally, I think, how things go. You don't know why you're succeeding yet.
Yeah.
You just know that you are. So the first part is getting enough momentum. And then the second part is, and this is the part about simplicity. I love Oliver Wendell Holmes' famous quote. I'm going to get it wrong, but it's basically like, it says something like, you know, simplicity before complexity is worthless. Simplicity after complexity is priceless.
Yeah.
And I think what he means is those of us who get to simplicity, I think like the model that, you know, Quinn and Cameron's model that I sort of been working on for 30 years, right? The innovation code was, it's actually extremely complicated. You know, yeah. It predicts share prices and it does all these things, but to get it to these four colors and these four quadrants took forever to do. You know, then there's other people who kind of, you know, do pop-up quizzes on BuzzFeed, which are worthless, which, yeah. you know, they've given 2 minutes worth of thought to, and people take it and put the same credence. So to me, simplicity has an elegance to it that's come from the other side of complexity, where you've sort of taken everything out that's not essential.
Yeah, and that's in the web space and what I do with our agency. That's the number one part of my job, is to take what is complicated in the mind of the client and simplify it in a way that's obtainable, not only to them, but also to their customers, to boil it down to what's really necessary to accomplish this beautiful word, this Hebrew word. I think it's Hebrew. It's either Hebrew or Greek, acharit, which is the end. And I think a lot of people get messed up with bloat and bigness because they miss the beauty in the simple.
Yeah.
To get to simple, like you said, you have to work through the complex to get there.
Yeah. In fact, one of the things your listeners might want to think about is, what if the key to creativity in your life isn't starting something new? What if it's stopping something old?
I mean, most
of us don't have capacity anymore. And one of the things that the people around me get about me, you know, my staff gets about me, is I'll come in probably every 2 or 3 weeks and say, I'm taking these 2 or 3 things off my schedule. Who wants them? Right. Hmm. Because the notion is something else has come up. My career is very fluid and I'm going to say yes to things that need to be saying yes, but I'm going to stop certain things, you know. And I've had projects where I've been into the projects and spent a lot of money in the projects, and you realize it's sort of like being a trader on Wall Street. You have to sell your position sometimes to say, I'm not going to have time or money to work on what I need to work on if I'm still doing this project. And that really throws people. But if you think, I want people to really take this to heart. Think about something in your life, if you simply stopped doing it, it would throw off enough time and money for you to write that novel,
yeah.
you know, for you to start that, you know, that food truck thing that you want to do. But until you do that, you will never have capacity.
Yeah, I'm in that moment right now. I started my career as a pastor working at a church, and I ended up in the world of web and technology because the recession hit in 2008. And now I'm at this place now where I'm going, the very thing that sustained us and made our business what we are today is the very thing that's killing the future of where we need to go. And it's a hard place to make those pivots. So I think the thing I'm searching for in this moment is, how do we recognize the emotion that's driving decision versus the rational thinking of how we should follow the creative path into the future?
I don't think it's one or the other. I love where you're at, Michael, and we're all there. And that is, remember, creativity is what drives constructive conflict, positive tension, and it creates hybrids. So to me, I look at what you're doing of saying, you know, what is, you're in the communication field and you have a mission in life. You have a Christian mission in life.
Yeah.
So to me, you know, that's kind of what brought people to where you're at podcasting or television, maybe the previous generation. So what's it look like in the next generation where people are having experiences? Well, this is where it gets kind of funny, because it's kind of like going back to the future, yeah. but in a new form, if yeah. you will, in a hybrid form. And I think of it this way. What I would think about in your career, if I was giving you some thoughts on this, not that you asked for them, but let me think.
I'll take them anyway. I will take them.
I want you to think about like how circuses were dying.
Yeah.
And then Cirque du Soleil did 2 things really interesting. They made the circus much more theatrical, and then they made it much more participatory with the audience. Well, think about what's going on with, you know, with spirituality and religion and whatever. I mean, the whole movements of what's happened with sort of conventional religion, and then we get sort of more evangelicals and we get sort of the New Age movement. Well, where does it go from there? I think it's going to be more participatory. I think it's going to be more, I don't want to say theatrical, interactive, maybe it's a better word.
Yeah.
And then you start thinking about, you know, all the possibilities for that. And I would think less about technology because technology is going to happen. It always happens. And I think more about how young people like experiences. And I think it's really powerful, right? This is what I, one of the things I think I'm really focusing on is, in order to get young people to have more cognitive mobility, how do we create more? I'm working on this right now with a new class I'm starting in the fall. How does it become more theatrical? And it's not pandering. What I'm trying to do is figure out, how do I get them to cross that bridge? Mm-hmm. And the reason my generation crossed it, I'm a boomer.
Yeah.
You know, I worked on a supercomputer with a slide rule. I mean, people don't get this. You know what I mean? We built your world with, you know, primitive, you know, rocks, you know, we went to the moon that way too, guys, just letting you know. So we had to work around. Your generation doesn't have to. And that's, you know, that's, and younger, real younger people don't have to. So I love this tension in your life. I would, instead of trying to avoid it or worry about it, I'd be working through that. Because I think there's a gold mine at the other end. I don't mean it materialistically.
I just think
the creative ideas are going to be there.
Yeah. I want to take a step out of the book for a second to explain to the listeners just a simple observation about the book. And that is that it is proactive. I see really kind of four sections of each chapter. There is the tools, the teaching, the text of what you're learning. There is the stories that you and I'm going to get this. Is it Stanny's? Is that your
Stanny?
Yeah. Okay. You tell some stories, both of you, in that from personal experience. Then there is the let's practice sections, which is getting into what you've just learned. And I think often that's the missing part in a lot of the books that we consume is, here's the information. Now, what do I do with it? And yet you go that step further to say, well, here's what you do with it, you know, and then turning it back to the reader and saying it's your turn. And I love that each place. It's a book of practice. You cannot get to mastery without practice. And I love that about the book because I feel like it's a book that you can come back to time and time again as you work through ideas, as you work through problems.
Yeah, I think the key to this is the very beginning of the book, I talk about mindset.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can do anything without a mindset. I think mindset precedes everything, you know, and I think this is where I am in alignment with a lot of the self-help books. But so, for example, one of the hardest things to teach an MBA is to look for anomalies, incongruities. So I just recently had a group where they were consulting with me, and I said something. I kept asking questions like, why does this not go with this? And you could see at the beginning, they're really irritated because what they want to hear from me is, well, what's the next step I need to take? And, you know, what box do I need to check? And I'm like, wait a minute. Now there's a thing that doesn't make sense here. And what was sort of the gift was about halfway through this project, this thing that I asked them was an anomaly blew up. Right. And they recognized, well, this is what you're asking us. And I'm like, they said, how do you know this? I said, I didn't. What I know is when there's incongruities or anomalies, there's an opportunity for sense making. This tells you that the dominant worldview, the dominant logic isn't working, and you have to think in a different way. So before you can remedy that, you have to understand that this is what's going on. And when you start looking at like what's coming next with the economy, or, you know, Michael Berry's ideas about hyperinflation or whatever, you start seeing that what people are queuing on, they're getting the same information you are.
Yeah.
What they're queuing on are these things that are incongruous. Things that don't go together, and they're not letting your dominant logic put them together. And what they're doing is they're sense making out of this, which is the first step before you can make a decision. What does this mean? What does this mean? What does this mean? And that's it. People don't like to live in the ambiguity, swim around in the ambiguity for a while.
Sorry about that. I'm writing a note off of what you say. I write notes. I work in the world of technology. I write code, and yet 90% of the best things I do, I write in notebooks.
Do you know why? Do you know that when you type, it goes to a different part of your brain? When you write, it goes to the neocortex, which is the front part of your brain.
I didn't realize
that's why writing, we're primates. I mean, well, hopefully we're souls, but we're higher primates, right? So when we write, it goes to a very specific part of the new part of our brain.
Yeah.
And when we type, it doesn't. And so what happens is, there are these very different modalities we have for creativity. So when people write creatively, there's something called inner speech, right? And what happens is what they're using a different, it's not their fingers that are creating, it's this talking in their head. So we have all these things that go on that are sort of gifts to us for millions of years of evolution or whatever you believe about the world. And we have to become more, we become virtuosos with the tools that we were given.
Yeah. That leads me perfectly. Either you're reading my notes or my mind, one of the two, maybe a little bit of both. You mentioned in the elaborate step, something that William James said about the stream of consciousness. I think we call that today in a lot of circles, especially the mindset space, flow. Yep. And you're talking about that self-talk. You're talking about working through the tools that are innately built into us instead of relying just on the technology, and how that connectivity, how we process is different depending on how we approach the problem. Talk to us about, you know, the book is about figuring out ways to innovate and be creative. It's tools to do that. And I feel like the pinnacle of that is when you really master that, you get into this place of flow. You get into this place where you're just like, it feels like you're doing exactly what you're supposed to do. It feels like it's natural.
Yeah, it does. It feels effortless and timeless. You know, Mihai wrote a lot about this in the 90s and he was right on. I think there's even more to that. The Greeks used to believe that, in fact, we get this, kreatos, right? We get a lot of our terminology from the ancients, right?
Yeah.
And they believed that the muses came to visit you, one of the nine minor goddesses, right? The god Calliope, the goddess of music, so on and so forth. But the reason that that's not a silly idea is whether, you know, whether you believe in holy books, or there's always this feeling to this day when you get an idea that somehow it's caught you and it pulls you along, right? That's the flow idea. So it's no longer something you possess. It's something that possesses you, right? It's you are now possessed with the creative idea. And that's why when you meet people who are really able to actualize all that, they feel like it's a mission, like they've got some kind of spiritual mission that they have to bring this into the world, right? So there's this very powerful thing when an idea catches, right? And the hard part of this is a lot of times it happens to people and they're not prepared for it. So people like me walk around with little notebooks in our back pockets, and we walk around with phones, and we walk around with, and I'll stop on my, I'll be running and I'll stop. And everybody looks at me, I get off the track and I'll start writing stuff down. And why? Because those are sacred moments. Those are, you know, sacraments. Those are, you know, some, and it depends on where you think the ideas come from. And, you know, you can believe they come from your consciousness or what happened during the day. Aristotle thought that, right? Or you could think that they're messages from God. That's the Hebraic tradition, right? But the notion is they come from someplace else. And you know, this is where Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell and all those guys goes, you're tapping into something. And there's interesting, even to this day, there's two theories, obviously, that come to us from Everett Rogers, to the great sociologist. He used to teach here at Michigan before he went to Stanford. And he calls them diffusion and polygenesis. And diffusion means it's clear where an idea came from. But I'm a much bigger believer in polygenesis, which means things show up because it's the right time of the world. So, you know, why does the combustion engine show up at, you know, three continents at the same time? Why does, you know, Einstein and Bohr have the same idea, basically in a different language at the same time, slightly different angle on it. You know, so the notion is, I think that there's something about the situation, and our experience in the situation is what the great philosopher Merleau-Ponty called it, being in the world. We're beings, we're matryoshka dolls. We're nesting dolls inside of other nesting dolls, right? That there's a moment, that Satori moment, that enlightenment moment when the idea catches you.
Yeah.
And that's the key.
Yeah. I could go on hours and hours in this conversation. I know we need to move towards the end of the conversation. Before we dive into the rapid fire questions, I wanted to get your observation on something that I think I'm noticing, I think others are noticing, and that's, and I think it's not just this one company, but I think this one company really exemplifies what's going on. And that's the change in Apple from Steve Jobs to Tim Cook. It felt like Steve Jobs was able to capture an idea, a transformation, a moment in a way that Apple isn't able to do any longer. that Apple's still doing great things. It is a phenomenal business, but it's kind of lost that DNA of large step innovation, of massive creativity. And now they just seem like doing smaller innovative steps, which isn't bad. It's just different.
I think it's, first of all, full disclosure, I was an advisor to Jobs when I was really young on something called Applied Integrated Systems, right at Apple when I'm really a young man. So I got an up close look at that. You know, Jobs is visionary, classic visionary, saw the world before the rest of us saw it. It could become petulant when the rest of us didn't see it. I think the problem that anybody has is something called Schumpeter scale. There's a guy named Joseph Schumpeter, who's a famous economist. And he basically said, companies are created by these amazing, just wild creative people. And for the most part, they fail. And he said, and he gave us the term entrepreneur, right? He gave us back the old 17th century French term. He said, but then they find somebody who's good at business and they focus, the simplicity part. Then they find people who are good at people. And then eventually they create enough bureaucracy around them and enough structure around them that they can do things at scale and be efficient and have quality. But Schumpeter scale says, this is the point of creative destruction. He says at that very moment, every person on the Capitol Committee, every metric that you've got, every hire you're making is designed to design out deviance. And what Schumpeter says is what several Nobel Prize winners, what are called behavioral economists, have said since about 2000, since the year 2000, we had several of them who said Joseph Smith was wrong. Basically, what they're saying, and not Joseph Smith, Adam Smith was wrong. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Adam Smith was wrong. And what they basically mean by that is that we're not destroyed by competitors. We're destroyed by our dominant worldview. And I'd like to give you an example of this. I like to tell people.
Yeah.
People love to talk about Sears in this terrible way. Well, if you start thinking about, you know, who started commercial email? CompuServe, Sears. You know, who started, 401ks on Main Street, a company called Dean Witter, you know, had a child called Morgan Stanley, Sears, Caldwell Banker, Discover Card, go down the right, you know, Prodigy, Allstate, go down the line. Sears invented the modern digital world. They invented it, right? Well, what was the problem? Was somebody a competitor to Sears in doing all this? No. The problem was, which is the fundamental problem that businesses have, they try and put the new into the old. Let me repeat that for your listeners. The fundamental problem is trying to put the new into the old, right? The new will inevitably win out. And so it wasn't Amazon, which was created the year Sears got out of all these businesses, that destroyed Sears. It was Sears that destroyed Sears. And this is where I'm totally aligned with the behavioral economists of saying, you know, I think Adam Smith was wrong about this. I think that our dominant worldview holds us back. So think about this for a minute. Imagine today, after taking this COVID vaccine and doing it in 10 months, imagine they're trying to put this back into these bureaucracies that could not handle this.
Yeah.
Which side are you going to bet on? I'm betting on the now making, you know, making medicines and therapies in 10 months. I'm not betting on the old group anymore. And the classic problem with companies, they try and take that radical new idea and they try and put it into the old idea. And I can't get into this because of the company they work with, but I have hundreds of examples of this. Wow. of something that we worked on that was a game changer, only to watch 10 other companies that were startups do it and the big company sit on it. And that becomes the problem. It wasn't that the big company didn't know how to do it. I'll give you my favorite example of this. Think about Tesla.
Yeah.
Everybody talks about Tesla and the radicalness of Tesla. You should have your listeners look into something called the EV1. It was commercialized in 1992 by General Motors. Take a look at the engine. Take a look at the patents, right? And ask yourself, who got what? What happened? Why did General Motors, who got here, 20 years before anybody else got here, why didn't they commercialize this?
Yeah.
Right? They only made 3,000 cars. And, they had some extras. They buried them in the desert of California. It's amazing.
It almost seems like that sense of urgency has to be kept.
Yes. And necessity is the mother of invention. And I come back to the edges of the bell curve. Uh-huh. Nobody innovates in the middle. They innovate when in the crisis because the risk of trying something radical and the reward of staying where you're at is reversed. That's why poor people often are the most innovative people. And it happens when you're on a roll. Look at Elon Musk. you know, only what he only lost, what, $500 million this quarter, whatever it was, right? But he's on a roll. So he's trying new things. So when you're at the edges of the bell curve, you innovate, and innovation does not move out, does not move inside out. It moves outside in. Innovation mm-hmm. moves from the edges to the middle, not yeah. from the middle to the edges.
There's a lot more we could talk about. And it's been an honor to have you back on for this conversation. There's something important we haven't talked about, and that is, how can people find you? How can they find the book? How can they connect to this? Because I truly believe that for the future of our culture, for the future of America, for the future of generations coming up, this is something we need to get back to. And I think that your book gives a handbook that really helps that process.
I think, first of all, thank you for that, Michael. My goal in life, my mission in life, is the democratization of innovation, creativity, innovation, right?
Yeah.
Which is the way I grew up. I would say go to jeffdegraff.com. There's a ton of free stuff, free books, a lot of stuff. You know, I've been writing, I was one of the original LinkedIn influencers. So if you want to go to LinkedIn, I'm one of the original influencers. I write a piece every Monday called Motivational Monday, and a lot of stuff's on there, a lot of videos and stuff. I think those are the two best ways to do it, right? The two, jeffdegraff.com or go to LinkedIn, and I'm one of the influencers. I think the big thing also is read lots of books on creativity and innovation, not just mine, and try stuff. Please try stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's the big thing. Get your swings in. I don't know how to put this. That's the way you're going to do it. And stick with it. Just please, please, please stick with it, because it's not effortless superiority. And the first book you're going to write it's not going to be a bestseller. It's going to take you to the second book and the third book. And sometime around, you've developed that muscle. You're going to go, wow, I know how to do this. Just like you're talking about your podcast. I was podcast 12. You're now podcast 300 and something. You know, it's much smoother, right?
Yes.
So you've learned a few things along the way. Me too.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to take a break right here. And when we come back, it's rapid fire questions. We'll be right back.
Earlier in the show, I told you that we're launching this show in video format on YouTube. If you haven't already, make sure you head on over to jumblethink.com/video. It'll take you right to the YouTube channel, and subscribe and turn on that bell notification so that you never miss one of these conversations. The video shows are coming soon, so go do that right now before you forget. Head on over, jumblethink.com/video. Now let's jump into rapid fire questions.
Levez seulement le bras pour mettre l'aiguille sur le disque. Mettez le contact.
We are back with Jeff DeGraff. Before we jump into this, I want to mention, Jeff mentioned links. They're in the episode notes. We're not even going to make you work for it. Just click the button, click the link. It will take you right there. You can get the book. You can connect with him on LinkedIn. You can start really consuming this information. And I really encourage all of our listeners to do that. All right. Are you ready for rapid fire questions?
I am.
As a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Football player.
What is one book you think every dreamer should read?
Think and Grow Rich.
What do you wish you would have known when you first started out?
How it's about the gift and it's not about the occupation.
Now, we've talked a lot about the first half of your book. There's much more. I'm still reading through it. And a lot of people are going to be further behind where I am, and definitely further behind where you are on this journey. So if somebody has a big idea and dream and they don't know where to start, what is the first thing you would recommend that they do?
Number one, I would recommend that they try to visualize the dream all the way to its completion. Mm. So they have a narrative in their mind that's a working narrative. I would ask them to then think about what's unique about your dream that's different than everybody else's dream. And I would double down or focus on that. And third, I'd look at myself and say, what skills am I missing? And who do I need to collaborate with who has those skills?
Mm.
Knowing that there's going to be tension. You know, it's always the person who says, well, I'm not good at money. Well, you need money. So find a person who's good at money.
Yeah. How do you define success? For you personally, how do you define success?
for me personally, it has a lot to do with my family. You know, do I have the, have I created a good life for my family? And I would say the legacy that I, that I've left, have I left a decent legacy? And anything above and beyond that, I think is, you know, frosting on the cake.
What is one trend you are currently excited about?
I'm excited about that, the maker trend. I'm excited that people are going back to their garages and their kitchens and their basements, and they have this deep sense of destiny and personal empowerment. And I think that's important. And I think it's been missing for a while.
Our final rapid fire question is, what is one dream that you are still wanting to fulfill in your own life?
I think I'd like to write a novel. You know, I've got a couple more book obligations in my life that I have to manifest, but I'd like to write a novel just to say I did it, just for the experience.
As we wrap up, we always like to leave our guests have a final thought. For all of us listening today, what do you want to leave us with?
Very simple. I think in order for our nation, in order for our world to continue to move forward, we need to include everybody in our democratization of creativity and innovation. A more diverse, a more just, a more inclusive world. And what we need to be doing, rather than trying to drown people out, we need to be building bridges between people and finding ways to climb that ladder together.
Great place to leave the conversation. Jeff, thank you so much for being back on the show. It's very rare we have a guest on two times. I think it's only happened a handful of times, and it's an honor to have you back on. So thank you for being on.
Michael, thank you so much, and thank you to your listeners.
Once again, I want to thank today's guest, Jeff DeGraff, for joining us on the Jumble Think podcast. You'll be able to find those links in the episode notes. Go ahead and click them and check them out. I really think you're going to enjoy what he has to offer. I also want to thank you for tuning into today's show. It's an honor that you would sit through these conversations. And my dream, my hope, is that you would get a little bit of a spark, a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of wisdom on how you can make those dreams and ideas in your own life reality. But at the end of the day, it's up to you. You have to choose to get off the couch. You have to turn the TV off. You have to choose to step out of the comfortable and the known into the unknown to create the life of your dreams. So I hope you will take that challenge. I hope you will take that step. I hope you will make a movement forward to turn those dreams and ideas into reality. Now it's your turn to get out there, to dream big, and to change the world around you. Étirez-vous doucement, mais complètement. En avant, en arrière, sur les côtés. Vous êtes une autre personne. Les mères de famille, les enfants, peuvent également prendre un moment revitalisant. Dans quelques mois, lorsque vous aurez bien saisi la technique et que vous serez maître de votre corps, vous pourrez vous décontracter même en travaillant.